All right, we made it.
Is that the thing we needed a quorum for?
That was, I knew. I knew, Roger. I wasn't going to say it.
That does not let you off the hook.
That's right. No, we all do know this is really important information we cover, and we're glad to be here. And appreciate the work that everybody does on this effort. So what we're going to try and do is about 15 minutes or so on most of these items, just to kind of keep people about sort of moving our pace, because I do want to respect the timeline of being out at noon. I know that people have a lot going on with session just starting. It is a race at the moment. So the traffic safety grants process, Wade. And I'm just going to put my own timer on for like 15 minutes, and I'll give you a sign at 15 minutes.
Hopefully it doesn't take that.
Yeah.
Good morning. Again, my name is Wade Alonzo. I'm the program director here at Traffic Safety Commission. I've been here since July. What we're going to talk about is a grant process we'll be using in 2020. We're proposing making some changes to. I'll talk about what our current process is to remind you of that. Talk about some of the things that are driving this change that happened in 2018, and then talk about what we're proposing for 2020. So this is the current process we're using right now. Process starts in November of each year when Traffic Safety opens a call for proposals. This is a general call for proposals that goes from November to January. That usually generates a little over 100 proposals. Staff look at all those, and they do an initial review of those in February once they're all in. It usually generates a lot of questions. We go back to the people that are proposing those, ask them questions, get more details. After that's done, then staff conduct a second review of all those proposals, and they start to rank those. We have a lot of meetings here to rank those and prioritize that list of grants that we're looking at funding for next year. Once we have a ranked list, we take that to a technical advisory committee, typically in March, and that group again reviews that ranked list. Once that list is further refined, it comes before you in April. And that is then the sum total of the portfolio of projects we are proposing for funding in the following year. And we follow the federal fiscal year, so this occurs in April. All those projects would begin in October. So once you all approve that, then we roll all those projects up into a highway safety plan, and that's submitted to NHTSA on July 1 each year. Once that's approved, then our grantees get letters notifying them that they've been approved, and then our program managers begin the process of negotiating contracts with them, usually over the summer. Again, to start those contracts October 1, they run for 1 year, they would all end September 30th of the following year, and then we would submit our final report to NHTSA in December of that year. So that's the process.
Any quick questions for Wade on any of this? Wade, is there any reason, I know that grants can't be made more than a year? Is it the funding is just really, it's given year by year? And
No, actually, I'm going to address that.
Okay, great.
Okay, so I was going to point out that every grant, every year, goes through this process. I mean, we do new contracts every single year for every grant, even internal grants. But I'll get to your question here in a minute. So some of the drivers of change that happened in 2018, NHTSA changed the process we used to submit our application to them, and they adopted what was called the Grants Management Solution Suite, or GMSS, and it was an online solution, essentially. And what that required was far less detail from us. It didn't require project-level detail, which I'm going to explain here in a moment. It only required strategic level of detail, which is a big departure from prior years. And then we also did an exercise internally and learned 70% of the grants we funded in 2019 would be recommended for continuation in 2020. I'm going to go into more detail of that in a minute. Next slide here, Grant Committee. So let me just spend a moment explaining the structure of the highway safety plan that we submit every year. It has four tiers. The first one is program, the program title, and that's centered around a highway traffic safety problem. So an example would be the impaired driving program. Under that are countermeasures. These are strategies to address the problem. An example of a countermeasure for impaired driving would be high visibility enforcement. The next below that is activity. That is how we're going to implement the countermeasure on the ground. So that would be, for example, for this example, would be giving funding to local agencies to pay for overtime for officers to do extra patrols during high priority areas, like times, like during the holidays. And then the project would be the actual contract that gets that done. So a contract with Auburn Police Department for Lewis County Sheriff to get that done. So that's sort of how it's organized. The top three tiers I'm calling the strategic level: program, countermeasure, and activity. And then below that's the tactical level, the actual projects. Okay, next slide. Prior to 2018, what we were required to do was, when we submitted our application, NHTSA required all these level details, strategic and tactical. In 2018, when they changed the program to the GMSS, they're only requiring the strategic level to be submitted. Next slide. And again, what we found was that would allow us more time to develop our project level detail. We don't have to have that. And it's sort of, if you work backwards, we had that deadline of April so that you can all approve that. This kind of gives us a different opportunity. It also invites a more strategic approach. Now let me explain what I mean. Go back one slide. So what they're asking us to do is submit the program countermeasure activity, which I would say is the strategic level. That's where we determine all the strategies we need to be funding. What we've been doing is doing a general call for proposals every year for projects. And what we do then is we spend a ton of time on the project level detail. And then 2018, what we had to do was, create the strategic level to fit the projects we had already decided to fund, which seemed like there might be a better way to go about it. Instead of going from bottom up, start from that strategic level, work down. And so that's kind of something that sort of started us thinking about how we might do that in future years. So go forward. So another thing we learned in 2018, we did an exercise with program managers, and we asked, if you look at your 2019 portfolio, these are grants that have already been through this process and approved, how many of these grants would you recommend for future funding, for continued funding? Either because they're multi-year projects or ongoing projects, the Black Grant, WSP is a good example, those get funded every single year. And they said, well, 70%. When we tallied it up, we found out that 70% of the grants that we'd be looking at in 2020 would be sort of auto-funded because they just make sense to do that. And so we thought, well, if that's the case, does it really make sense to do a general call for proposals for 70% of our portfolio when it's not really needed? We thought this would be an enormous opportunity for savings, time savings for our staff and for our grantees. So that's a good idea. So we started looking at that a little closer. So based on all that work, next slide, what we're proposing for 2020 is that we roll forward essentially that 70% of those projects that need to continue, we would just do that. Instead of creating a brand new highway safety plan every year, we just update it with the projects we already know we're going to fund. Furthermore, we propose that the program managers, this kind of puts program managers more in the driver's seat strategically. These are the subject matter experts in the state. Puts them in the strategic driver's seat to figure out what their programs need to be focusing on, and then gives them the ability to do that. And the mechanism we're using is a program plan. Program managers all have business plans. We're changing the name to program plan. We're restructuring those a little bit so they're more behavior focused. And that's what we're using to identify going forward what our priorities should be. So for 70%, again, we're going to be working with our grantees. They've already been notified of this. But we're going to be amending and extending their contracts. In some cases will be new. But the work involved will be far less than if we're starting over with a brand new slate. Then the proposal would be that we would use that to identify, the strategic level of program countermeasure activity, roll that up, and then that's what we'd be bringing to you to approve in April. Next slide. Now I can take questions if there are any questions.
Amend, extend contracts. Will dollar amounts be involved in that conversation, or is it just a time extension? An amendment would be a non-financial amendment to the contract.
That's a good question. At the moment, the assumption is that we would keep grants at their existing funding level, but that could change because of once we have the whole list in, we see what the priorities are, and we see the actual amount we get from NHTSA, that could change some. Some cases they could go up, some cases it might go down, some cases it might stay the same. At the moment, we're envisioning keeping them the same. That's sort of what we're thinking.
Wait, how long would you have the grants go for? I mean, is there a period of time where you say, okay, you've been given this grant, we've extended you these 2-3 years. How do we determine your productivity, and has it gone down or up, continued? When does that get evaluated? Is it every 2 years, every 3 years?
That's a great question. There's a couple things involved with that. We've created three teams internally to help guide this process. One of those teams is called Program Plan and Performance, and we really want to put more emphasis into the performance measures we have so that we can better assess and work with our grantees and say, hey, you know, if you're hitting this mark, we know you're making a difference. So we really want to work and make sure we have the right performance measures. Generally speaking, we like to work with our grantees on sustainability plans so that we are not generally funding a program forever, but generally 3-year timeline is what we look at. So it's kind of different in each case.
Sure.
Sometimes we're refunding research, which might take a couple years, maybe 3. Other cases, we're really working on single-year projects. Kind of depends on the actual nature of the grant. But we are opening the possibility of having multi-year contracts now.
Sure, Snada. We're not advocating. We would still be doing the quarterly reports and then the end-of-the-year reports. Those would still be continued requirements.
So contingent on performance kind of things is what I'm hearing, and quality improvement if there are performance along the way.
Correct.
Issues.
Correct. We can at any point work with our grantee and say, hey, we're seeing this, we'd like to amend. We work with them on that one formal process to amend. And I can see that happening. You know, at the end of the fiscal year 19, we work with these grantees and say, hey, we'd like to tighten these things up or change these things. So yeah, we have that ability.
Does the funding from NHTSA change substantially from year to year? Is it pretty consistent?
It's pretty consistent.
Okay.
I mean, it's not real high or low, but it's pretty consistent. So the amounts that we've already appropriated for the grants and continuing forward, we hope to keep at that same level. And then based on some of the performance, or if there are changes within a grant, say that they lost X number of people that they couldn't work on anymore, so we can adjust accordingly based on that. And it gives us a little bit more flexibility to work with the grantees.
So we can take that money and put it on something else if they don't use it, or we can...
Yeah, and we've had just recently had a grant where the grantee put in, and then based on some things, they were not able to even do the grant. So a large sum of money has already come back. So, and those happen periodically. But ultimately, is being able to give some of the grantees more of an assurance that they will. It's not just a 1 year, but it could go multi. So you can actually see the changes over time within a particular area. So whatever that might be.
I would agree with that, because, you know, when you just do 1 year, it's hard to measure that 1 year. When generally we do a 3 year, I mean, how's it looking a 3 year? Because you can have anomalies come up 1 year and then have a great year the second year, or whatever it is, more manpower or whatever we have going on. So 3 years works a lot better than doing it every year.
Yeah, so. I mean, traditionally the way that a lot of our grants are set up are to be demonstration projects, being able to get in, do 2-3 year projects. Sometimes they've been extended into 4, but really to then have, you know, get that established and then let the jurisdictions take that over on themselves. So that's traditionally how we like to do some of those. Now there's some projects that are just kind of, you know, the up one time, you know, they just need some startup costs to get going, and then they go from there. So, but ultimately is really being able to give, I think, for the allowance for time, being able to put things in place, productivity, seeing a change in maybe the culture or whatever it might be. So this is, I think, a big change for us. Plus, the workload on the grantee isn't every year having to do a grant and spending, you know, a ton of hours on that. Plus, coming back to our office and the arduous meetings that we may sit in for like 2-3 days, you know, they're not bloody battles, but they're challenging. So, but this actually helps us to be more strategic in our process.
Roger, thank you.
I was just curious, are you seeing, I mean, in the current process, you're reapplying every year to keep that multi-year grant going. You're reappropriating too with the legislature? or is this outside of the...
This is all federal grants.
No, it's federal grants, but it's outside of the... I mean, we have the same thing with our federal grants, but we're dealing with it with the lead.
Yeah, we already have the appropriation authority for that, so yes.
And Mike, that was one. And then the second question, since we're going to get the technical response, I'll get the whole question out. Is there a wave out there? Do you see that appropriation growing? You know, I sit on the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board, which is primarily state money, but they'll award a grant and it'll sit there for 5 years, for 10 years, unspent. A lot of times they wind up, they're kind of like lottery tickets. You know, here's your grant, now you can go pursue a bigger grant because you've got our money. And the result of that is there's $20 million in that account all the time. And I've been pushing to, if there's $20 million in that account all the time, we have the ability to spend $20 million more without asking for any money. So I just want to make sure how it is today and as you modify it, that it doesn't result in appropriation building up and not being spent.
So, if I can try to do my best Debbie impression, because Debbie Jones is not here. But we do have carry forward funds,
yes.
And we're constantly trying to account for the carry forward funds. So while our NHTSA funding is pretty steady, carry forward funds have caused us to ask for an additional federal appropriation this year, mm-hmm. because you know when we do a statewide. Emphasis Patrol and all of the agencies around the state get some money. This agency may spend up to this point, and, you know, little amounts get left behind, and then that ends up being a bigger amount carry forward. So we're trying to figure out how to make sure that that all gets spent down, and that we have the authority, even though the NHTSA funding stays kind of the same, to account for that additional, so that we're not stuck at a level of not being able to spend everything that we have available.
Yeah. Okay. And we've tried to create you know, more of a ceiling for us. I mean, I'd like to have no ceiling, but because you have unanticipated receipts where you get funds in or grants in that, you know, were not even on the table originally when you began the fiscal year. And so, you know, we may get some private grants. We have some grants that have come in from, like, the Governor's Highway Safety Association or the Foundation Advancing Alcohol Responsibility that really were on the table to begin with. But we still have to show an appropriation level. So, yeah, that's part of that. So this is a good thing.
One thing I forgot to mention, our goal is near the end of March or April, we will intend on releasing a focused call for proposals. So once we've been through program planning and we understand more of our priorities, then we're not doing a general call, but we're doing a focused call. We're saying we're looking for projects that achieve this and kind of spelling out that in a lot more detail.
So why don't you explain for the April commission meeting what the commissioners would anticipate seeing and the approval piece. So because I know now with the technical advisory committee that we have, who I will be asking for a representative from each of your agencies to be a participant in that. But can you explain kind of what that will look like for them now? There's a little bit of a change.
So I guess what I'm envisioning at this point is that the program plans will really end up creating, I guess, the highway safety plan. The problem, NHTSA is very much driven by problem identification. So the goal is that our program plans really do a good job of fleshing out our problem IDs, and then the strategic direction we need to take based on the statistics and research we have. So what you will be looking at, what we were seeing in then is, I think, a more detailed level that's more detailed description of the strategic level. So problem ID, program problem ID, a description of the strategies we're pursuing, and then the activities. So I guess a more robust description, I'm guessing, of those three levels. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, and not the... So before we've given you all of the projects that we were going to fund, and this time you'll be looking more at the strategic level of activities that we think would be the best to do the countermeasures that we think are going to solve the problem ID. So it's a more detailed strategic look. And then after you give us approval for those activities and to do that, then we'll be looking to fund those activities with specific grants, which is the level that you were seeing before. But at this point, you'll be giving us approval that, yes, you think these activities are the right activities for us to do.
So maybe it'll help to go to that one slide where you're showing more of what they're going to approve.
Go back to back a few slides.
I'd like us to look at that slide, and I'm going to come back and ask the commissioners if there's general support.
That would be the levels. That would be the levels you'd be presented. So you wouldn't be getting project level detail. You wouldn't be seeing a list of every contract with every single grantee, but this higher level.
So, commissioners, different direction? Is there general comfort with staff moving in this direction? Any concerns other than ones that were already raised?
So I think last year when we looked at these, there were some specific grants that I think raised some concerns, particularly some of these. I think that you and I have the same concern about some of the grants that looked like they were ongoing funding for things that really should be state funds rather than grant funding.
Right.
So will we be able to identify from this level of detail that kind of an issue, or will it be, is that too granular for what we'll be actually seeing?
As a vision, you wouldn't see that granular level in April.
Would we see that later, or?
By April, you will have 70% of the projects is already cited. We will have, and we could provide to you, so you can still see those. For the other 30%, which is not, I mean, it's such a convenient number, but it's not really how it will translate. We won't know necessarily the projects the call will have just started, so we won't necessarily know the other 30%. But for 70%, yes, and actually you've already approved all of those, so. I guess the projects going forward, you wouldn't necessarily see those yet.
Is there a point in time when we approve the final list, like later in the, or is that now what we're saying staff do in it?
I guess what we're envisioning is the staff do that work after you've approved the strategic direction.
On both the continuing projects and the new ones?
What I'm saying is that you are giving us approval for this,
right, correct,
and then we're determining the detail below that. That's what staff would decide.
But we can get a breakdown of the emphasis areas that each grant is attacking and have some sort of idea,
correct,
as it rolls along,
correct,
what they're actually doing. I think that's kind of what we want.
Yeah, we can give you all kinds of
detail. That's what I'd like to see. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. We can give you all kinds of detail that shows, I mean, for example, the percentage of funding going towards impaired driving versus motorcycles versus distracted. Right. We can provide you all kinds of detail on that. We can provide you, all kinds of lists, whatever you'd like to see, really.
Just to address the projects that you guys were flagging as maybe these should be statewide, those were both coming out of traffic records, and you both have staff that sits on the traffic records. And so, in some ways, the majority of assigning from activity to project is going to happen at these group levels. So we have traffic records, we have WIDAC, we have the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council. So you'll have lots of input, and hopefully also a way for the staff that sits there when we identify something that is more appropriate for state funding to raise those issues up to you guys to see that there's these opportunities.
We're more over time than I'd like, but this is, I think, an important topic. So when do those, remind me of the timeline, when those projects actually would start receiving funding?
So projects begin the new grant year October 1 of each year.
Okay.
A little bit change of an issue going forward with NHTSA is that they don't require project level detail from us until
July 1.
They do, I think. But we can provide placeholders when we don't have detail yet. And then when there's an amendment process built in, we can provide that later on.
So my personal preference would be able to see the final list and give sort of final approval of that, in part because I want, we're asking really busy people to come to this table. And if we're going to have lines of insight, I think, into the issues, I need to see that line of insight personally and be able to ask these questions. Is this something we agencies should be putting forward in department budgets, not coming out of this? Is this sort of moved out of the realm of grants? Being able to see that in terms of our own programs, staff are working on this. They're really competent. but the leading up to us isn't something that always happens in a timely fashion, and I don't personally necessarily make it a priority if I know I'm not at this table. So as just one voice, I would like the ability to see that that finalist approval in April for the strategic and say, great, sounds good, I get the 70%. Would like to personally see the, but I don't know if I speak for the rest. So, Roger?
I think I share that sentiment. And I'm also interested in, you know, maybe you can answer now, maybe you wait till April, but we're making decisions as a body that have been delegated to us by the legislature. Do we have the authority to delegate it to staff? Would be a question. Mm-hmm. And is it appropriate to delegate it to staff? Because you're awarding contracts, which means people are getting money, which means other people aren't getting money. And they look to the commission.
Right.
And so as much as I dislike paperwork, if it's truly a staff function, let's delegate it to staff. But I'd love to see some analysis of that. You know, because I don't want to take something that I'm responsible for somebody else to, you know, I don't want to delegate it inappropriately.
One more thing. In 2020, the number is 70%. But going into 2021, that is likely to go down. Like some of those projects that were multi-year are going to start dropping off. And what we'll be moving more towards is more targeted, more focused calls for proposals in the future. This is a 2020 is a transition year, so that's what we have to check.
So two of us have sort of given our points of view on this. Is there anybody who really, again, depending what the statute says, is there anybody who really says, look, I don't want to see those. I don't think we ought to be seeing those in the end and doing final approval.
I have a question. Make sure I'm tracking this. So the program is you identify an area like reduce impaired driving. Countermeasures, what level decision is countermeasure? Like, what kind of decision would come under countermeasure? Just an example.
Which countermeasures we're actually pursuing?
Reduce impaired, let's just make one up. I mean, just so I get an idea what the level is.
So what level, I'm sorry, what level?
Like, have
what's the countermeasure to reducing impaired driving?
You have impaired, what level, what type of decision? I'm not saying what the specific decisions actually are, but what type of decision would come under the category countermeasure?
So we would decide to fund, for example, or pursue a countermeasure like high visibility enforcement again. Example, with impaired driving, it's a huge, huge program.
Right.
And it's multifaceted because we have the Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council that has a state amount of state funding. So it's a little kind of a complex one, but with impaired driving, that group right now is actually going through a strategic planning process
right.
As far as Target Zero. Am I answering your question?
I'm just looking like, for example, just so I can understand the level of this decision that goes into these three categories. And then activity would be like support statewide emphasis patrols or something along those lines?
So I think
the activity would be conduct high visibility enforcement.
Yeah.
And then the actual grants would be, we're going to give an amount of money to Lewis County Sheriff's Office for overtime so that they can have officers out during the times when we've decided to do statewide patrols.
So the
we contract like 150 contracts with different agencies.
So would the activity be, okay, we're going to issue contracts to various law enforcement agencies?
Correct.
Or to a particular law enforcement agency?
That would be like, activities is a bundle of different kinds of projects, but at the same time. So yes, in that case, we will fund HV contracts with local law enforcement agencies. And then our project would be the contract with Lewis County.
But that would be it would not be activity, that would be the next rung down.
Correct.
Specifically Lewis County.
Correct.
And what you're proposing is this commission would not actually see those.
Correct. That's what's being debated, yeah.
So what, on impaired driving, it's also funded by state funds, right?
Correct.
So are we the group that sets the policy that we want to get to Target Zero by reducing impaired driving, and then we give out funds to law enforcement agencies to do that, yet there's a state, what's the state money doing?
SB, you want to talk about that?
I mean, I know there's, we aren't, obviously, we aren't doing enough money. We don't have that kind of money to do that. So what's the state doing? What's the roles between the federal funding and the state funding on this particular issue?
Sure. The Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council meets quarterly, comprised of subject matter experts from multiple disciplines within impaired driving. There is an authorization provided by the state of Washington. It is fed or fueled by fines assessed at the breath test and the blood draw to the defendant. And so those funds get routed through the WIDAC to disseminate with very specific statute language in which it says, you know, it will go to address impaired driving issues and programs for local communities. There is some very specific language in there in which a large chunk of those funds goes to specific counties. So it's our charge, myself and the other impaired driving program manager, Mark Medallin, and we facilitate the work within that. And as Wade mentioned, we're developing a strategic plan that will hopefully guide those resource allocations for the near future. And all of those subject matter experts that have been identified are helping us write that plan.
So when you say this is 2020 will be kind of the transition interim time, are you seeing coming out of that more of that kind of approach? What's the policy level and what's the...
Yeah, exactly.
Because it seems to me it's kind of, we possibly kind of mushed up right now.
So I'm going to try and summarize where we are and see if this is a place where we can move on. So I think what I'm hearing as a group in general is that at the April 18th meeting, we'll hear the strategic piece and be asked to approve that. In order for us to do that, we need to see it in advance so we can come to the meeting prepared and have adequate time on the agenda to discuss these kinds of questions and to make sure we're comfortable. That there's going to be some checking to see what the statute says about our authority to delegate or not delegate the sort of approval of the actual grants. With some understanding that some of us are interested in that level of detail and would like to approve it so that we can be thinking strategically as well about the whole package. Is that a reasonable summary of where we are? And if that's kind of what the notes summarized, would people be good with that?
I would indicate I would have some reservations about having it totally stop off at the activity level. Because, it's again, I tend to use stupid examples to illustrate my, go to the absurd to illustrate my point. But for example, if we set the goal, actually it's not, it's too stupid to even really make sense. I'm just going to say that there could be a situation where, you could have a situation where there's some actual grant that's being proposed. People would have would say that doesn't really come under this activity, and it's a situation. If strange things get funded, ultimately I think it comes back on this group. I have some reservations. I may have them satisfied later, but right now I have not been sold.
And I go back to sort of one of the first meetings we had that I was a part of where there was issues people wanted to bring to the commission about some of the proposed allocations. So I would really like to end this here unless there's something important to say.
I was just going to add important. Is that under the new federal process, the hard part is with the actual project level details, is that those projects could be ongoing throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And so they may not just be an October 1 start date. And if I'm incorrect in that, please let me know. But the way that they have changed this process has kind of changed a lot of things of how we are looking at this. Right. So the project level detail is something that you would be able to receive for all of our grants. But as far as the approval process, because right now we have the authority to go in and change projects even after they've been approved based on some of the changes we've had with the subgrantee. So, but we would make sure that you have that project level detail. The big challenge is when would that be approved, because they have a July 1 start date. and then our commission meeting is until the end of July. So unless we change it to a June commission meeting, so.
Right, we may want to relook at that.
But those are just some of the elements to just consider, so.
Yep. Okay. Thank you so much, Wade. Appreciate it. We've really cut into time here, so we're going to try and move towards close to 10 minutes, realizing once we go over 10 minutes, we do have some time, but whatever time we chew up, Darren gets less in the director's report.
So, I think some people are okay with it.
Yeah. Well, that's why you're last on the agenda, apparently. Okay, so Shelley, the request legislation.
I can do my
best. I really am going to like put the timer on so people hear it this time rather than my just watching it.
Because you have all of these materials, you can actually review them yourselves. What you received in your packet is both our Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council report and our Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council report. There's a page that looks like this in each of them that give a nice overview of the recommendations that these councils have worked towards and made. They've divided them up into a new system this year using the principles of sustainable safety. And that was a nice change that they've made. We've got a nice little roadmap on how those work, what the principles are, and then what the recommendations are that they're making under each of these principles. So, if you have specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, you can review these on your own. Know that these reports went to the governor's office. We received our approval. They've been sent out to the legislature this year. I believe the House is probably going to ask us to do a work session on these, so we'll have a chance to talk with them in depth with the legislators. But for both councils, the first under cross-cutting recommendations, the first recommendation they made is to combine the councils. So you may remember about 4 years ago, the legislators asked us to take up the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council. Two sessions ago, they asked us to have the Bicycle Safety Advisory Council. Both of those expired June of this year. And at the time, their thinking was that once these expired, we could combine them and provide some cost savings for running these both of these councils. So we submitted request legislation on behalf of these councils to the governor's office. We've received permission from the governor's office. I have my green sheets, and we'll be going out to look for sponsors to sponsor a bill that would provide us the ability to combine these two councils, continue them into the future instead of ending them now, allowing them to continue to look at the data, to make the recommendations, and then track how we're doing on recommendations. Because once we got them all together, they weren't all legislative recommendations. They were recommendations on what we could do as agencies, on what they can do as advocates, and so that's where we're at with that. If you have any questions, we can get deeper, but if we want to save time, we can move forward.
Do I remember from a previous meeting that there was general support from those two groups, and so we're anticipating stakeholder support of that, is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah, stakeholders are right on board. In my mind, there's a little bit, because the legislators had advocates and the legislator had asked us to do this originally, and now we're kind of taking the mantle on representing these groups to ask the governor's office and the legislature to do it. It's a little bit of a change from how it was done before, but we feel like that was the most coordinated way to move forward.
So are we circling back to the legislators that suggested we do this for them to sponsor?
Yeah. In fact, both of them, I expect, will sponsor. Okay. Yeah.
That's good.
They informally told me they will, so now it's just a matter of, here's the green sheets. I meet with one tomorrow.
Cool.
Representative Clova and then Representative Leas.
Good.
Friday. So nice. Hopefully we'll be on good track to move those forward. It's not been a huge traffic safety bill year so far yet, but I have captured those that have come up. We've seen some of these before. The child passenger safety bill that would change a little bit of information around how parents restrain their children. Last year it was pretty prescriptive trying to come up with ages. Of course, we want to keep children in the biggest protection for as long as possible, the best protection for as long as possible.
The video of the kid falling out of the car in the car seat is just going to maybe push this one.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was.
Thank God they have a good car seat.
The right car seat for the right child at the right time is critical. Yeah,
hooking it up is another thing.
Yeah, it is complex.
Obviously.
There's some motorcycle safety ones. One is the DOL motorcycle safety bill, which we actually have signed on with as well. And
which one is the DOL bill?
The DOL bill is 1116. And then there's some that are concerning another attempt to remove our mandatory helmet law for anybody over the age of 21 and over. In the past, we've had a very strong supporter in the transportation chair, Representative Chief Clifford, who retired this past session. We have a new transportation chair, so I'm not sure if he'll be as... I mean, Judy just would never put it up for a vote, so we were in a really good place. I don't know what will happen this year. I'm concerned.
So these are the ones that have signed up to take it off?
That they would like to remove it.
I see. I see my senator there.
And
Mr. Braun, Lewis County.
The first name is the prime, isn't that right?
Yeah, it's actually coming from Senator Wolfus. It's 5007.
Brains on legs.
And it would also require us to study the effect. We've done this before. We removed the helmet law. We saw 30 additional motorcycle fatals the next year. It remained high. And so we reinstated the helmet law. Fatalities fell. So as far as it being a pilot, we kind of already know what will happen if that happens.
We saw what happened in Michigan as well.
Just for the good of the order, we submitted, we hardly ever ask for money, but we submitted a budget request package this year to the legislature and made it into the governor's budget. We're asking for $150 for the budget part if they fund the policy of the Active Transportation Safety Advisory Council. We're asking for $273,000 for the biennium to support our work with the automated vehicle, thank you. Automated vehicle work group, and a little bit of money for both a position for IT and a position for research that would be more state. So we have our FARS researchers that have to follow the federal guidelines and do all of our traffic fatals that go into the FARS system. This researcher position is more state focused and reaching out and helping us do data sharing agreements so that we can build our access to data. So those all made it into the governor's budget. Who knows what will happen when they go through the process, but that's where they're at now.
Yes. So one thing on the motorcycle safety, and Dara and I have discussed this, but I've talked to a couple of legislators, fortunately, that they're getting presented data and studies, right? And so what Dara and I talked about is, I know you have all addressed that and you've thought about that and compiled it, so if it does get a hearing, hopefully, just put facts with facts. But I think that's part of it, is you get this very official looking study, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to spend 20 hours researching it, so hopefully we can count that.
Yes.
And we've been preparing since summer. Stacey and her team have done a really great job doing some literature reviews, yes, finding out exactly what's there.
And unfortunately, what we have seen over the last 5 years, we average about 73 motorcycle fatalities a year.
Yes.
And last year was up to, I think, 82, 83, but that five-year average is about 73. We can't seem to get below that.
And so are there still the boomers out buying the motorcycles and jumping on them?
It's a variety of ages, but what we are seeing is that it's about 60% are the single vehicle or single bike, or is it 70?
I guess.
Huh?
60% is a good guess.
Yeah. A lot of them are single bike crashes, as opposed to what the public would think is that the motor vehicle is the one that's cutting them off, or, you know, they're getting hung up in traffic, you know, and there's another potential lane splitting or lane sharing, as they would say, bill that's coming forward. But those are some things that, you know, if target zero is our true value, why would we do anything to jeopardize safety in any regard? So,
yes. Shelley, quick question on this draft bicycle safety report. Page one, 51 people died while riding bicycles in Washington State roads during the past 4 years. Is there information in here as to geographically where those occurred and around the state, and not just that, but whether it was a rural or an urban setting, and what a little drill down on where they took place? Scott's our coordinator.
I'm so glad Scott's
here. Hey, Scott.
So we did not put that location information directly into the report, but I absolutely have it.
Do you have that?
Yeah.
I would appreciate getting some of that if possible. Because I know we had one in my county, and that has affected the way, honestly, it's affected the way we look at our public works projects. I think it's important. Too. So.
If you could send that out, that would be really
helpful. Absolutely, we'll do that.
So on these bills, it would be helpful, I think, if you think it would be helpful for any of our agencies to sign in and support or testify or have a coordinated how we want to respond to any of these particular bills, I think that would be a good thing.
I will say that State Patrol and I are often very lonely in the room full of
right.
people.
So yeah, so.
So if anybody wants to join us or sign in,
Shelley, when's the next range on this?
I will let you guys know. So I don't. There's not been a hearing set for those bills yet.
So,
but once there is, we can send
on February 13th is Law Enforcement Legislative Day.
Oh, okay.
And so I have meetings with Braun and Tacchio. And I just text my brother. He testified on it the last time, and he'll probably do it again.
Yes.
So it's in support of that. So, and then we'll just have to see where WASPIC stands on it. But I think they support the helmet law. And so, but you can talk to Dean.
I will talk to Dean, yes. John's my guy, too, so I may be talking to John.
Yeah. I can't see him being supportive of this.
So in wrapping this up, I would like to ask that you do have commissioners here. I think what we need to know from you is you don't need to be lonely, but we need to know sort of from you all what you would like from us and when hearings are, and we can work with our legislative staff and even your, I don't know if you have a legislative director who can work with our legislative directors, but you don't need to be alone is my point. And but we need to be led up to on that so that you're not alone.
Yeah, they meet every week in their legislative liaison meetings, but I think there are some agencies that aren't represented right. within transportation
yep,
with
that very
department
health.
They've had some good game plans. So yep.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, with the motorcycle,
yep.
the helmet law, getting one of the most effective comments I've ever heard at a public meeting on issues like this came from emergency room doctors and nurses.
Right.
And you know, if you're in law enforcement, somebody coming in and saying, this is what comes in to where I work.
Yep.
That works really well.
I agree. All right. Last comment.
Just quickly, I just left the State Association of Counties meeting at the Capitol, and there was a whole group of motorcyclists up there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm present. Talking about this stuff. So.
They're coming to me with me.
They need to say right. at least that we don't pay for their injuries.
Yeah. Call Medicaid and
Medicaid.
All right. So Therese Hansen from Department of Health and David on Commission Traffic Safety Target Zero feature. I messed that up, but you know what I'm talking about.
So good morning. Thank you, John, and thank you for inviting us here and your interest in the opioid work. Since we have 10 minutes and that bell's going to go off a lot quicker than I had hoped, I'm just going to fly through these. So I just want to give you a couple of slides with the data. Here's where we are right now, and you'll notice the dotted line, and this is the national trend on all opioid data. You'll see that we've had a sharp increase since 2013. The national line is in there because my boss always asks about the national line, so I made sure it was in here. So the national rate is at 14.9 per 100,000 at this time for all opioids. Opioids are heroin, fentanyl, prescription drugs, tramadol, various other medications. The second line is 739, and that's Washington State's all opioid overdoses. And you'll see the trend line from 2000 to 2017, and we're at 739 of all opioids. When you look at the magenta line, you see prescription drug overdoses, and this is where we're very happy because there was the uptick until 2006. Little by little, it's coming down, and now we have 342 in 2017. However,
That is, as you will see, the success is erased somewhat, actually substantially probably. I don't know how it'll be in 2018, we're looking a little bit better, but 306 heroin overdoses, so the successes we made with prescription drug are offset. And then the last line is fentanyl. And while the U.S. Opioid overdose rate has skyrocketed largely due to fentanyl so far in Washington State, we have not been so deeply afflicted, but we are getting an uptick. We watch it very closely. We watch it closely with the tox lab and with the medical examiners, so we're trying to keep track of this. There we go. This, I'm just showing you, this is a, some of the stuff that we do at, in Department of Health. We do a lot of data, so we send this out. This is goes to the counties, basically, and it's a bird's eye view. Basically, it's a statewide roll-up for the 5 years, and the overdose rate for opioids in that 5 years was 9.3 per 100,000. And you see opioid overdoses happen throughout the state.
I just like to stop it, and I will say my county commissioners in Cowlitz County told me that they thought the opioid epidemic in Cowlitz County was a result of the coroner being overzealous in his reporting and his death certificates of opioid use. So head in the sand, head in the sand.
Thank you. Good comment. Next one here is by age group. And you will see here, we pay closest attention here. The highest burden is in the 25 to 64 age range. We're seeing the upticks a little bit in the 25 to 34. We've had a decreasing trend in the 45 to 54. 15 to 24 is fairly flat. Most of those that are in the 15 to 24 are over 18. 14 and under is fairly flat. So this is by age group. And then in the 15 to 24 area, most of that uptick is psychostimulants, and we're seeing some fentanyl there. And then this one I just put up here because I asked my epi to do one with psychostimulants, because this is an opioid epidemic, and at the Department of Health, we are very concerned also about methamphetamine. It keeps growing, and we watch psychostimulants very closely. So we have one epi who's very passionate about this. So it's really something we need to pay attention to. And if you look at the yellow line, you can see just a really, really considerable increase that's going on. So this is really important to keep in mind as we're doing our work. And it particularly impacts youth as well. So this is important to us. So what are we doing about it? We have the statewide opioid response plan. There's the link. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, I would direct you to it. It's got lots of great information that can tell you all of these. We have a multi-headed hydra here. We're doing a lot of different works with a lot of different agencies and a lot of different partners. So it helps guide you through the bolus of work that is going on right now. We have four priority goals. We have six work groups. Actually, we have seven because we just added a tribal work group that is coming online with HCA, I think, as we speak. So this is good news. All work groups, then we have leads for the various work groups, and then we're all pushing to priority goals, which I will show you here. So we go according to priority goals: prevention, treatment, basically naloxone distribution, and then improving our data. These are our priority actions. Here's the funding, because along with all the hands to do all the work, it takes a lot of money. And so at this point, it's a little bit higher than this is showing, and in 2019 it will be even higher than that. But here are the main grants for the Department of Health. We work with mostly CDC funding, and then we get some state funds. HCA, and Sarah's here, they get a lot, most of their grants come through the SAMHSA funding source, and they are doing some tremendous work with the money that they're getting. So they're creating a whole hub and spoke system. I'm not going to address that today because I don't have time, and they're the experts in that area. General fund, by last year's legislature, actually, no, it was by the proviso. It was $20 million through the proviso. And I think this year, the governor's budget request is about $31 million, if I'm not mistaken, and about $20 million is going to treatment and recovery, and the request is for about $10 million for prevention. So that's where we are in terms of funding sources. So when we're talking about prevention, what are we doing? The main thing that the Department of Health is doing is we are working on the safe prescribing. This has been going on for a long time. So since it's key to addressing the epidemic and the impacts of all ages. Since 2007, we have been working on guidelines, starting with agency medical director's first set of guidelines. We were the first in the country to do this. We were ahead of the CDC and any other state. So we implemented various prescribing guidelines that are then that have then been the subject of different pieces of legislation. And as of January 1, just the other day, with the House Bill 1427 addressing the prescription monitoring plan and implementing the acute and chronic pain guidelines went into effect. So this is a long haul. I think it's also the reason that the prescription overdosing is going down. So this is an important piece of it. Medicaid also, they have their prescribing policy for acute pain. So the prescription part and the prescribing part, working with the doctors and the healthcare professionals, is really a big part of what we do. Here's the prescription monitoring program. Many of you perhaps have heard of this. This is at the Department of Health, and we are currently collecting 1 million prescription records monthly into that system. It's huge. And because of all the advancements that have been made with the system, we are getting those prescription records within one business day. So this allows us to keep track, and you'll see with the Health Information Exchange, they have connected with I think it's about 14 health systems, so that there's an automatic flow going on. So this is a big advancement. We have some technical issues that we're trying to address. Other than that, we're...
And what's a health system?
Sorry?
What's a health system?
So, for example,
Kaiser,
MultiCare.
Or?
Yeah, MultiCare, like one of the bigger systems,
okay.
Kaiser.
Kaiser
systems. Okay. Yeah, not the smaller
Peace
clinics.
Health.
Most of the smaller clinics so far have not been able to join in the health information exchange,
right,
mostly because of cost.
Right.
But the bigger systems are absorbing the cost, and we're working in that direction.
Good.
And so with prevention as well, and in trying to get make sure the healthcare providers are working in the right direction, the Department of Health, through the Prescription Monitoring Program and under 1427, send out reports to individual prescribers, providers and prescribers, and they also will be sending the reports to the chief medical officers of those hospitals and clinics. So this is sort of an evaluation system and keeping everybody informed of where they sit in conjunction with everybody else, a sort of a peer review thing. And then public dashboards. We have six opioid prescribing metrics that have been settled with, some of you may know, the Breed Collaborative. And so we have created dashboards that the public can go in and look at and, So two more things, okay. Provider education is a big part of what we do. We have a public health nurse on staff that goes out and works in all of these communities with all of these providers to basically educate them on the prescribing guidelines, and then also to help waiver doctors to become buprenorphine providers. And buprenorphine is one of our strongest evidence-based treatments, so that's a really important piece to do the uptick in the provider education. And we have, at this time, we have 2,500 waivered providers. However, they're not all prescribing and they're not all taking patients. So this is becoming one of the issues that we focus on very, very closely. Okay, so John, do you want me to be quiet?
I want you to wrap up.
Okay. All right, and so here's the campaign. Both HCA and Department of Health ran public campaigns, awareness campaigns. We took the CDC, their vetted campaign, we retrofitted for Washington, and we rolled it out, and we will continue to use that. And I think, since I have to roll up, the last thing I want to talk about is naloxone. And the naloxone distribution is coming over to the Department of Health. We have found that with the syringe exchanges, most of the people who have naloxone kits got them at the syringe exchanges. So they have witnessed overdoses, and they can help prevent deaths. So this is a piece of what we're trying to work on very solidly, and having it at the Department of Health will be also helpful to us. And then we also have a final dashboard. We have moved in the department to quarterly reporting. It used to be you had to wait a full year to get any of this data. We now have moved to quarterly reporting, putting it on dashboards, and then we track it every week internally. And so that's all I have.
Sorry to have rushed you. Thank you, Daryl. You've got 8 minutes, and then we'll do 2 minutes of questions on either of these topics.
I'm just glad it wasn't five.
Right. All right. Jump up there. You're using your time, buddy.
When the boss says jump, and I go, how high?
Don't we wish?
So I'm Dave Harrelson, and I guess I need to learn how to use this thing. Okay, up and down arrows. Okay.
Right here.
No.
Right here.
Right there.
Nice tunes. Okay. Or maybe you can just
I'll
say
yes. I'm Dave Harrelson, and I do work with the Washington State Department of Health. I'm in the Marijuana Prevention and Education Program. I've been there for about 3 years. I spent 10 years doing tobacco prevention and control for the department, and so now I've transitioned to illicit drugs, although it isn't in this state anymore. So I wanted to start first, before I dive into the program, just as she did, just a little bit about the data part of this. Based on the Healthy Youth Survey, and the data for both adults and youth around behavior is coming out in around March. So this data is going back to 16 and 17. But for youth, we're finding marijuana use pretty much flat. It really is not changing significantly. And when I looked at the adult data, youth is around 70%, adults are around 15%. Adults, however, are increasing roughly a percentage point a year since legalization. One of the alarming things beyond the data staying flat is the perception of harm is getting worse. The kids don't feel it's dangerous because they see their parents and the confusion with the medical side of the use of marijuana. They see it as a natural substance, those kind of things. So sometimes it's very difficult to get through to the kids.
It's a decreased perception of harm.
Decreased
usually precedes increase in use.
Yeah.
So, for sure.
smoking of marijuana is still the most common, but there's also an uptick in vaping and an increased use of marijuana within vaping devices. Actually, vaping devices are being used for a variety of different substances, and with the Juul and the devices like that, it can be easily hidden within the school, so it's very difficult for folks. I'm sure with law enforcement, you run into the same things. Also, we're beginning to see more and more just the linkage as far as poly use, that you're beginning to see the vaping and tobacco and alcohol and all these things kind of wrapped up together. And what I've learned over time is that if you see one, you're probably going to experience that there's those other things that are going on. So the poly use is an important thing. And of course, the major issues we're concerned about are just that I think in terms of the research, the thing that most people agree is it does affect the brain development. The research on marijuana and a lot of other ways is just emerging because there hasn't been a lot of research due to the fact that it's illegal federally. But we're finding the evidence that people really feel like brain development is something that really, especially around kids, they want to pay attention to. We're also seeing that in treatment programs that marijuana frequently is the only is a drug that is being used with other substances when they come in. So it's pretty prevalent in terms of what we're seeing in treatment programs. We're also seeing that somewhere around 9% of regular marijuana users as youth drove while using marijuana, and roughly around 19% of youth rode with somebody in the car. And the driving with it is roughly equal to where alcohol is, and also riding with someone in the car is roughly the same as it was with alcohol. And I know Traffic Safety Commission did that report about accidents due to marijuana, accidents due to alcohol, and the combination, and how deadly that can be.
Cheryl, which slide would you like us on?
Yeah, this one. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Back one more.
Sorry.
Right. Really quickly, this, if you're not a data geek, then this won't make any sense to you. But what we're seeing is that the disparities in youth marijuana use are greatest among most of the racial, ethnic, and LGBT populations, other than those that are self-identified as Asian or white. However, our program is really focused on a lot of these populations because they're disproportionately impacted by where the shops are being located, the advertising is being targeted, and those things. So there's a lot of inequities around that. So go to the next one. So now to the program. Again, our focus is because of the mandate. It started with an issue 502, became a statute, and the three mandates that we have is that we will have a grants program that goes out into the community so that we can mobilize local communities, a media campaign that's focused on youth but also does some work around adults, and a helpline to help folks. The original amount of funding that came was through the dedicated marijuana account that was established upon legalization. It started out around $7 million a year for the first biennium. We're now just short of $10 million per year over the biennium. And a lot of that money is either used in the media campaign or going out into the communities to be used. Let's see. We're really building this work on the foundation of both the foundation that Healthcare Authority Division of Behavioral Health Recovery through SAMHSA has developed around best practices of doing substance use prevention, but also it's an interesting merge into how public health addresses issues. Substance use prevention traditionally has been more on an individual and small group level. Public health is much more around population-based, so it's looking at changes in policy systems and getting messages and environments to reinforce and discourage the use. So go ahead to the... So this is part of the mandate, is that we have the community grants. We have nine regional, we have the YMPEP, which is the Youth Marijuana Prevention Program. And that's going out to regions based on accountable communities of health, so it fits into the health transformation work. Mm-hmm. Those folks, over the first years, whenever you're standing up a program in the local community and you want to engage a lot of folks, their primary work in the first years have been recruiting members, educating them, getting them on board with this work, helping them to make some local decisions, looking at the data, setting up a strategic plan so they can be very targeted in their work. We also, though, following on what we did with tobacco, is that we're working with contractors and priority populations to culturally tailor the approaches and to have the people from that community talk to people in their community in terms of addressing the issues. They also have a lot of the work on both of these has been just educating people on the state law and also the dangers of marijuana. People are really confused with the medical side of it and the appropriateness of that, and just, you know, what does research say and those kind of things. So there's been a lot of work around how does marijuana impact. We also have a statewide media campaign. But we also, just in the last couple years, have, just as we've done with our priority populations, have tailored media to those specific populations. And it's being done by folks in those communities, not by our big media vendor. We've actually changed our contracting process a little bit to get to some folks that are in those communities and not to a big vendor that maybe has an African-American or an Asian staff person on board. The final piece, go ahead. Don't do that more.
That's good. Final piece. You're good.
Okay. Really quickly, these are the different campaigns. You may have heard Listen to Your Selfie. That was the initial launch. You Can is for those kids that are in their early teen years. under the influence of you is really getting to the parents, coaches, and so on that are influencers of the kids. Know this about cannabis is really our only adult piece of it. We're not trying to tell adults it's good or bad, but to put information out there so they can make good choices, lock up their weed, those kinds of things. And 5 Things to Know really isn't a campaign. It's materials that are designed for pregnant and parenting women. Just because of, again, the research is emerging, we're putting that information out there. The last piece is around the helpline, is that we are putting money through the contract that the Division of Baby Health and Recovery has to enhance some of their staffing and some of the training so that they can respond to marijuana-related calls. And so I'll skip this. And I guess the bottom line behind this, and maybe go back one, is that the department has really placed a high value on addressing health inequities and disparities and so on. So our program is paying a lot of attention with our locals in terms of identifying priorities based on where those disparities exist. We're obviously paying a great deal of attention to accountability and monitoring the performance and changing our activities and approaches based on evaluation we're doing. And the inclusion actually is probably more about collaboration. We're part of a broader substance abuse prevention system that was really anchored by DBHR initially. And so we work with them, we work with the Traffic Safety Commission, we work with Liquor Cannabis Board, and that's both at the state and the local level in order to affect the changes. So that's it.
Thanks. Apologize to our speakers that I'm going to move us along because we're going to end on time. So if you have questions for anybody, see them afterwards. Again, truly, my apologies. One quality improvement for us is probably put time frames on our agenda so we can both plan if we've got enough time in an agenda, but also that everybody's aware of kind of what we need to be on track. So Wade, Celine, you have 10 minutes, and Darren, you have 4. So,
well, it's actually me, and my goal all right. is to be done before that little buzzer goes off.
All right.
So Darren has 6 minutes, maybe. Hi, my name is Nadine. I'm the Traffic Records Program Manager at WTSC, and I am also the project manager and facilitator for, Wade asked me why I put this up here, because this is the longest name for a work group ever, and I can't remember it. The Executive Work Group on Sector and Gendex Sustainable Funding Model. That's the name of the work group. You can go to the next slide. Does everybody here know what sector and Gendex are? I know you do. I know you two do. Does everybody else here know what it is? Okay. If I could remember what sector meant, I would tell you. It's statewide electronic collision and ticketing operating something, and Gendex is Judicial Information Network Data Exchange. Those are the two operating systems that take care of ticketing and collision records in this state. It is a system that was procured in 2006 and it was released in 2008, and I want you to keep in mind that that means it's 2005 technology, so it is now 14 years old. It allows law enforcement agencies to electronically create tickets and collision reports and other forms and send them to all the appropriate agencies that need to see them, DOL, DOT, they go all over the system. We have an issue that has been identified, and that basically is that the current technology system is no longer sustainable and it no longer meets the needs of the law enforcement community and also the agencies that use the data and need to put stuff into the system. So, a multi-agency subcommittee has been formed to assess new technologies and funding systems and determine what the best course of action moving forward is. We have two options. Number one is to procure a brand new technology system, and we've been looking at that. And the other one is to completely rewrite the sector code, modify it, and make it workable for the system. I do want to say up front that law enforcement likes sector. I'm going to look at you two guys. Law enforcement likes sector a lot. And they are, as far as I can tell, amenable to revamping the system. So we are looking at those two things. You can go to the next slide. So we started a year ago today, a year ago this month, we started meeting. And we, in 2018, we held a request for information for vendors around the country so they could come and show us their systems. We got 7 vendors that came. We have looked at a number of systems. We've looked at off the shelf. We've looked at people that want to come in and design one. And we've looked at a really interesting thing called the national model, which is out of the Iowa Department of Transportation, and it is a coalition of states that have gotten together, put together a e-collision e-ticketing system, and for a very nominal amount of money, put it out to all the states. You get a license, and you can give it to anyone in the state for free. So we are also looking at that model. And we've hired a feasibility consultant. Slalom Incorporated from Seattle has come down, and they are doing some feasibility work for us to determine the most appropriate solution going forward. 2019, we are completing the feasibility study. We will have it done by the end of March. So for this commission, in April, we are planning to come back to you with the decision and the recommendation that we've made and asking for your approval. We should also know exactly how much of a budget we'll need. And so you can hopefully have all the information and approve our decision going forward. We've been working with the OCIO to make sure that they are involved in the process and working with us. And we will be selecting a vendor. 2020, we will do decision package development and submission. And at that point, this work group will disband. And we have a group that does, that takes care of sector. It's called the eTrip Operations Managers. They are revising themselves to fit into this new project, and they will then take over vendor procurement and system implementation. That is their job. And so the work group will disband. We are planning, we hope, to have a system implemented by 2025. So that's it. Pretty quick, huh?
Well done.
Thank you. Well, I mean, you give me a time, I'll
read it. I know.
Any questions?
Or comments?
You'll be hearing a lot more from us in April.
Just inside your packets.
Oh, yes. And I forgot to tell you, inside your packets, we put together a fact sheet that gives you all the information that I just glossed right over and didn't even mention. And so it will tell you about the number of tickets that are being run through, the number of things we're doing with sector, why it needs to continue, a system of some sort needs to continue. And on the back, you'll see a schematic of how tickets are routed. So, any questions?
Roger. Comment. If this is great, I'm glad you're doing it. For those of us here that are in roles like mine, one of us has to go after the Holy Grail and do procurement reform. It should not take this long.
That's for sure. We agree.
I mean, you're doing the right thing by the rules. It should not take that many years to do a contract. And it's built into protecting the public's money, and I understand that, but it's not protecting the public's money when it takes 5 years to do a contract.
Thank you. Thanks. Anything else? Okay.
Great. All right. So, Darren, you have until 11:59, then we're going to wrap up the summary.
I've heard him talk. He can talk really fast.
Last time he asked me to chair the meeting, I was just
like, no, we appreciate it, and thank you for all being here, and I really appreciate the support because this is important work. Sometimes it goes kind of unhidden and sometimes it's, I think sometimes in traffic safety, you know, people go ho-hum, you know, it's just traffic safety, but in reality, it's about saving lives and making families whole. And you know, for us, you know, we never know if we could be the victim of a tragedy. So this is really about the work that we all do together. So thank you for being here. The partners meeting we had on December 13th, we had about 200 people at that meeting. And I appreciate all the commissioners that were there. I was going to show you the video, but I don't have time. So we will send that out to you just to kind of highlight what it was, what we did, how it operated. And it was really, really well done. We were down there at the Great Wolf Lodge. And we had a number of speakers, great speakers, including myself, Teresa Burston, Roger Millar, who was the star of all of the of all of it, and then we had Captain Jason Lynn out of the patrol, who did our opening remarks. So appreciated that. We're building up on that 2019. You kind of know some of the timeline. We're in the middle of all this right now. We hope to be completed with a package for the review so that the governor can sign it by August of this year. So we'll have the next one. We do those every 3 years. So in addition to our grants process, I appreciate your patience in going through that because this has been one of those change projects that we can see will save a ton of time for us as an agency as well as our grantees. And when you review the information and we come back in April, is to really put kind of our print on how we can make some of those changes, because they are transformational. And they really will be able to save time and money, but also help us to be much more strategic in how we approach that process. The Grant County Task Force is now up and running. We mentioned that at a couple of commission meetings ago. They made a grant. It was in the last grant proposals that you all approved, and we're now up and running. Nadine, no, where's, oh, Erica's not here. Erica Mascaro is the one that has been running that, and with Bob Thompson, and we now have three deputies over there that are concentrating just on traffic safety. And they've got their vehicles up. We went for a press conference in early December. It was freezing cold, but it was well done, and we're really excited to see that. Their city council representative came out and participated with the press conference, and they are hoping to see some significant changes in their rates over there. We've already talked about the bicycle and pedestrian advisory reports that are out. Pam and I did the House Transportation Committee's 101 on Monday, and then on today, Shelley and I will do the Senate's 101. And if you could pull up the slide really quick, one of the things that Stacy, could you close that door?
Yes, I will, sorry.
Is somebody stuck in the elevator?
Yeah, we broke the elevator.
Okay, good. Glad I wasn't on it. So. One of the main pieces that we're focusing with the legislature and kind of teeing up some of the issues for this year is the priorities that we've seen from the 2019 Target Zero data. The highlights in the yellow in the middle column there are areas that we've seen the highest change for the 3 years of the last Strategic Highway Safety Plan. So when we look at heavy trucks involved, drivers over 70 plus, young drivers at 16 to 25. These are some information that motorists, but also young drivers is another area that Teresa and I have spoken about, is working with with the legislature on young driver activities. Intersections, we've seen a big increase in that. But our biggest ones that we see here in the state, the change isn't, you know, as high as like heavy trucks, but impaired driving is 50% of all of our fatalities. So it doesn't matter how we slice and how we go up and down, it's around 50% of all of our fatals. And so those are areas of improvement that we can work on, and then distracted driving has moved up from about number 4 to number 2 in our overall fatality pictures for the Target Zero data. So just kind of setting the stage for that, wanting you to see the priorities, what we're actually providing to the legislature as far as the data that we have from our crash reports. So any questions on that?
Can you send us that?
Yes, we will send you this. This will also be in that priorities page in our new Strategic Highway Safety Plan as well, but I can provide this to you because we've broken this out, and as you will notice, we don't do priority 1, 2, and 3 in this report. We've changed that. We've all broken it down into high-risk behaviors, crash types, and then the type of road users where we're seeing the biggest issues. Motorcyclists, again, over that three-year period, 231 motorcyclists that we need to figure out how we can address that piece.
I'll put my war on cars hat on, Darren. Under the road users,
yeah.
Why don't you have a row for automobiles? You've got heavy trucks, got motorcycles, you got non-motorists. How about motorists, automobiles?
Okay.
It's a significant... I mean, what was the data team's...
So that specifically has never come up, but we do address the driver, the vehicle environment in most emphasis areas, so it's kind of represented that way. And then we do have unrestrained passenger vehicle occupants, where that is a motor vehicle-related one.
But I have constituents who say the fact we have automobiles on the road is a public health problem. So just, what's the number? If 80% of the fatalities are automobile users, it ought to be on the list. Just again, to keep those constituents of mine happy that they have a number they can point at.
Also, under the heavy truck involved, what we see continuing is that 75% of those fatal crashes is the passenger vehicle at fault or automobile.
Yeah, well, like the non-motorists, very, very few non-motorists bump into each other and die. pedestrian to pedestrian accident. That we don't hear about those.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things as far as that, the language. So we're going to look at that piece. Just lastly, in 2017, we had 563 fatalities in Washington State. Preliminarily, right now, for 2018, we're at 541. Now, that's preliminary because Stacy in the back will knock me over the head if I say it's final. This is about a 4% reduction, about 22 fatalities fewer, and then fatality crashes is the preliminary. We have 534 in 2017 and 494 fatal crashes in 2018, which is about a 7% reduction in fatality crashes. So I'm hoping that this is a change. We're trying to be optimistic, but you can see from here we have a lot of work to do. So I appreciate your support and all the things that you're engaged in with us. And with that, I will turn the time back to you, Chairman.
Well done. Do I remember that early in the year we thought we were going to exceed last year's, right? So
the early estimations were potentially in October. We were green in every month as far as below last year, every month. And then October exceeded everything. We had 76 fatalities in October. Which most of the time, our average is around, 38, 41 in the month. We had 41 in December. So if we could get, and in the month of July was the biggest month. I'm sorry, but we were still down from the previous year, but it was still the highest. And then October, we actually exceeded what we were last year. So, yeah, but we're down this year, and we're going to stay with that story. So
I met with the city of Copenhagen in October. They were on a full court press to stop the horrible fact that they had 5 fatalities.
So it can be done.
Yeah, 5. Right. And they were upset about 5. It's too many.
So our next meeting is April 18th. At that, we have two things that this commission needs to act on. One is the strategic piece of the grant that we're going to look at and approve. And then I think it's the vendor selection that we need to approve. So those are two actions we need to take, and which we need to make sure we have the time for on the agenda. Currently, we're scheduled to meet July 18th, but I think folks may need to look at that if we're going to have this group approve the actual grants. So that's something to work on in between, I think. And with that, anything else I missed?
John, just one more thing.
Yep.
Mandy will be sending out a request to all of you folks to identify your representative for the technical advisor committee that we mentioned.
Great. We'll look for that. Thank you so much, everyone. We prepared everybody for lunch session where you think you have 3 minutes and then you have a minute and a half. So well done. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.